Well, as we've been talking about, the 2016 election still not technically over in North Carolina with the vote counts and the challenges and the concerns all going on statewide. Nationwide, the Republican Party generally considered to have won the election. In a lot of ways, it was a wash. Democrats did pick up seats in Congress, even money at the state level with the General Assembly. Democrats likely to have picked up the governor's race, although that's still up in the air. Republicans did win a lot of seats on the state level as well, were able to hang on to their veto-proof majority in the state House and Senate, won the presidential race, but lost a couple of seats in Congress, still managed to hang on to majorities there. What is clear is that regardless of who else won or lost the election, the alt-right, however we want to define that, definitely won it, and that is a concern for people on both the left and the right that are now concerned with how to prevent them from triumphing anymore. And we're joined now by Ashley DeSena, Ashley Campbell now.
Yes.
Yeah. Have to get used to that.
Me too.
Yeah, I know, right? And we were talking about the Orange County Conservative, and we were talking about the alt-right and our concerns there about a couple months before the election, and now those concerns have sort of bubbled up to the surface yet again. So we're talking today about how to prevent the alt-right from triumphing any more than they already have, basically.
No, and I remember when we talked about the alt-right the first time, you're kind of like, the what? I mean, is this really important?
Yeah.
And I felt like, you know, as little chance as I thought that Trump had of winning the election, it still seemed to be some kind of political force bubbling under the surface. And I think on the right, I was probably a little bit more aware of it than, say, people who are more to the left or Democrat voters, because it was something that was kind of affecting our candidate and linked in some ways to our candidate that made, you know, more traditional conservatives like myself uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason for that is because the alt-right operates on this idea of identity politics, specifically white identity politics. Mm-hmm. And they are getting a lot of attention in the mainstream press and a lot of attention from just, you know, people who are progressives on social media and whatnot. And it's still a small movement, though, so I feel like it's being kind of overblown. Like, I saw somebody tweet that 200 people went to an alt-right convention in Washington, D.C., but there are, like, 7,000 people at a brony convention or something, which is guys who like My Little Ponies.
Well, I mean, the bronies are taking over. I mean, come on. I mean, is it? I don't think we can call it a small movement anymore, because 200 people were at that particular convention, but Steve Bannon is in the White House, so, or will be in a month and a half, so.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Steve Bannon, because I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, because it started with that announcement that, you know, Steve Bannon of Breitbart News is going to be, you know, part of the Trump administration, and was it chief strategist? I think
something
his
like
position
that.
new to me.
Insert title here.
Anyway,
basically, he's going to be in the White House. He's going to have
in
an
the
office.
White House.
Yeah,
and that's what got people panicked at first, because they feel like Breitbart it has served as a platform for the alt-right. Which I think it's been sympathetic to this group, but I don't necessarily think that Steve Bannon is representative of the alt-right itself. But
there's also something to be said for, like, the difference between people who identify as alt-right and people who sympathize with it and express ideas that are similar to it. Like, whether we identify Breitbart as, like, the mouthpiece of the alt-right or not, you go to Breitbart.com, there are a lot of pieces just every day on the website that are essentially expressing the worldview that you get from the alt-right, which is white people are under siege and blah, blah, blah.
There's some overlap, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a rejection of, that they share a rejection of political correctness and a rejection of a globalist agenda, which is basically just, you know, they feel like there's an agenda driven by the left to dissolve, you know, national borders, bring immigrants from here, there, and everywhere. The alt-right, of course, is worried about non-white immigrants. If you're European, okay.
Then you're fine, yeah. That's Canadians, fine. Come on down.
Canadian, right. Yeah, that's fine. So there are some overlaps, and Breitbart can be quite sensationalist. It's not my preferred news source by any stretch of the imagination. But that has... So you can see that there are also significant overlaps with Trump, and that, you know, he also is anti-globalist in the sense that he wants protectionist economic policies, lots of tariffs and stuff like that, trade deals, you know, he wants
deals,
to renegotiate
UN,
everything.
A lot of things, right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, of course, his whole campaign, I think, you know, there are lots of reasons that people voted for him. But I would say one of the top three reasons that everybody who voted for him did so because they had a feeling of too much political correctness in our society. So it was trying to be a rejection of that. And but the funny thing is to me is that the alt-right, like I said, it's built on white identity politics, and so they've joined the left in this. I mean, this is, to me, the left is playing this game of identity politics as well, where, you know, last time I was on, I was talking about, like, it's hard for me to understand because there's all these groups to keep up with, and you have, you know, like, LGBT identity politics, and you have African American, you know, it's race, class, gender, basically. Yeah. And
maybe add sexuality and religion or a couple of
other
categories.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, the big three are race, class, gender, right?
Exactly. But, you know, those are definitely in there as well. Definitely.
So the argument for how to sort of check the alt-right then?
I think we need to get rid of identity politics, period.
Okay.
Across the board.
Okay. What would that entail?
Well,
I've got my argument here, but I'm
okay.
I'm letting you get yours out.
I mean, I'm going to steal a lot of ideas from I think he's a behavioral psychologist, Jonathan Haidt, who is a professor at NYU, and he's quite famous now. So probably a lot of your listeners have heard of him before. He's written a lot about, you know, the moral differences between liberals, conservatives, libertarians, and their different viewpoints in approaching the world. And then there was also this really good piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago that was also written by a professor who teaches at Columbia called The End of Identity Liberalism, which I definitely would recommend people read through the whole thing. But basically what the author of that piece, Dr. Mark Lila, I think is how you'd say his name. He advocates something that is post-identity liberalism, which by liberalism, I just mean, you know, freedom, like all of our First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association, perhaps is the most often overlooked one. And he wants this post-identity liberalism that draws from pre-identity liberalism. And he makes this really important historical point as well, that the first identity movement in American politics was the Ku Klux Klan, which I think is true. Is, you know, as a student of history myself, I think that's accurate. I couldn't think of an earlier one. And so he wants to draw from the time before that, what he calls pre-identity liberalism. And basically what that entails is it's widening a base to issues that affect the majority of Americans. So it's really a majoritarian idea, and it speaks to the nation as a nation of citizens, and that we have to help one another, and that... It emphasizes a system of rights, individual rights, not rights based on whatever group you belong to, what your identity is. But then it also emphasizes the responsibility that comes along with those rights. You know, the freedom and responsibility being two sides of the same coin, in other words. So it's basically that kind of focus that doesn't emphasize, you know, your group identity so much as your identity as a citizen and part of a nation and working toward a, you know, a greater goal.
I'm going to, I want to go back to the idea that, because I think a lot of those points are exactly right, but I wanted to give a different spin on it, which is, we talk about America as being sort of the Lockean liberal tradition, right? That it all comes from the Declaration of Independence, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson's quoting John Locke there. So the entire history of American political thought and American political discourse and American politics all goes back to John Locke, classical liberalism, that basic fundamental, like, classical liberal idea of individual liberty, right? Like, that's the focus. So that means two things, and I think it's important for us on both the right and the left to keep this in mind. If that's true, to the extent that it is true, then first of all, we're all classical liberals on all sides of the spectrum. People on the left and people on the right, we're both ultimately concerned with individual liberty insofar as we all come out of that Lockean tradition. And it also means that whenever we're making arguments on the left and the right, that's the way the arguments have to be couched. So you're never going to do a good job selling any argument in American politics unless you at least make an effort to couch them in terms of individual liberty, individual rights, that sort of Lockean tradition that emerges in the Declaration of Independence and then just sort of spreads out from there. So I would argue that it's a mistake to ignore the fact that race matters, class matters, gender matters, because they do. And the extent to which we ignore that fact, is the extent to which we ignore real things that are actually happening. What we should do instead is recast those arguments in terms of individual liberty, because I think it is an individual liberty issue. When we talk about like racial disparities in policing, for instance, we've got the numbers. We know that when you are pulled over, if you are black, you are more likely to have your car searched than if you are white. If you are black, you're more likely to have your physical person searched than if you are white. If you have committed a traffic violation, you're more likely to be cited and fined if you are black, and more likely to be let off with a warning if you're white. And you go down all the way through the justice system. If you are charged, arrested, tried, and convicted of a crime, you're going to end up getting a harsher sentence on average if you are black versus if you are white. That's what, 12-15% of the population that's facing that every single day whenever they walk out of the house. And we talk about that in terms of identity politics, that's a liberty issue. Like, that's an issue where 20 million people, whenever they leave the house, they're dealing with that at least potential threat to their individual liberty, and we can definitely talk about it in those terms. John Stuart Mill is the great paragon of classical liberalism in the 19th century. He writes an entire book on the subjection of women specifically for that reason. Like, you can't talk about liberty without ignoring disparities even in terms of those demographic identity categories. And the same thing, like, you can make this argument all the way across progressivism. Like, Thomas Paine writes Common Sense and the Rights of Man, and in both of those books he spends all of his time, and this is his argument against hereditary monarchy, right, that it's a violation of individual liberty to bind our posterity. We shouldn't make choices today that close off options for people 20 or 50 or 100 years from now. We can make that argument with climate change. Like, to the extent that climate change is a thing, if we make irresponsible decisions today, we could be closing off options for people 20, 50, or 100 years from now, and that's a violation of individual liberty. Like, we don't have to talk about it in terms of clean air and the spotted owl. We can talk about it in terms of our grandkids not being able to make choices. I'm a really big fan of Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, who write about capabilities theory, like the idea that, okay, we're concerned with individual liberty. What are the preconditions for that? Like, what do you have in order to be free? And one of the points that they make is, well, you have to be able to read and write, right? First of all, in order to be able to make decisions, informed decisions and informed choices, why do we have a public education system?
See,
to make sure that people have that capability.
I followed you up to that.
All right.
I followed you up to that because I think that in order to be free, I just feel like we have, you know, an inherent right, an inalienable right.
Yeah.
you know, that we're just born that way and that you don't necessarily need
so like from to birth meet conditions yeah.
To be, you know, entitled to that.
Mm. But we can have that argument, but we should have it in terms of individual liberty. Like, how do we define liberty?
Right.
How do we do that? And
everything
I think we absolutely can
else,
do that.
Yes,
yeah.
Perfect.
yeah, definitely. And like, none of this is would be the left or progressives being deceptive or lying. These are liberty issues. Like, I was thinking about the whole debate about House Bill 2, not in terms of liberty issues, but, like, how did the dial move when people on the left stopped talking about it in terms of identity politics and started talking about it in terms of, oh, we're losing $700 million. Like, as soon as that became the thread of the conversation, like, oh, what's the economic impact from House Bill 2, that's when you started to see public opinion moving. So I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. And I wish that we spent, you know, more time looking at things from a more neutral economic perspective as well, because, well, I think that, you know, when people are allowed to act in their, or, well, sorry, I should phrase it, they're not prohibited from acting in their own self-interest, then, you know, that generates a more positive economic situation for everyone involved, you know, that increasing the degree of freedom. So, yeah, no, I agree with everything you said, and couching conversations in terms of individual rights. I think that's the place that if we can all start from there, we can have some really constructive conversations, like an actual dialogue. I mean, I go to lots of events where they claim they want to have a dialogue about things, but there's never any chance for a dialogue because you're expected to conform with one viewpoint. And, you know, from my perspective, that's a result of identity politics because it's all tied in with political correctness. Like, if you say the wrong thing, you know, that's not politically correct. You're not allowed to say that. And, you know, the fear I have really is that unless we start conversations from the concept of rights and the freedom and the responsibility that comes along with those things, because we can't get away from that, the other side of the coin, then it's just going to lead to more conflict, because you have one set of identities versus another. I mean, if we just allow this, you know, white identity politics movement to grow, the alt-right to keep growing, I don't see there's any way to avoid conflict. And so I just would love to encourage people on the left to think about couching their conversations more in terms of individual rights, going back and reading documents like, you know, the Declaration of Independence, reading John Locke, John Stuart Mill, and all, you know, the philosophers and economists, Adam Smith, so that they can have that context, because how can you talk in terms of rights without the historical context from which they came from? And so, you know, absolutely what you were saying about, you know, race and class and gender and you know, religion, all of that's still very important. So I wouldn't ever want to sweep that away, but it's just all about sort of making nothing taboo about discussing that. Like, nothing is politically correct anymore. You can question everything, you know, even if it's a really stupid idea. I think we benefit from having more of a marketplace of ideas, and that's, you know, that's a liberal philosophy. Mm. So I think that the individual rights, the beauty of that is that it leads to police a peaceful context in which we can, you know, build a more civil society versus identity politics that's conflict.
We got to wrap up there. We're at the very end of the hour. I want to keep talking for another half an hour. But Ashley DeSena, Ashley Campbell, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Aaron.